Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have with us Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University this hour. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Jeff Taylor from the northwest part of the state joining us in Sioux Center, where he's a professor of political science at Dort College. Jeff, it's been a while. Thanks for coming back on.
Good to be back with you.
We have a full slate, and we'd like to invite our listeners to join us in our discussion of any of these points. 1-866-780-9100. It occurs to me this is the last politics day, Politics Wednesday of 2018. Next week we'll be full of the holiday cheer and leaving the politics aside, at least on this part of a Wednesday. Later in the program, we want to talk about the uncertainty over the government shutdown due at the end of this week. Nothing is done. Michael Flynn's sentencing that collapsed this week. Those new polls put out over the weekend, both Republicans and Democrats polled as we look forward and see how each party's most dedicated supporters feel about candidates and the president. But let's start off with this passage, a bit of good news for the end of the year, at least in most people's eyes. Yesterday night, lawmakers overwhelmingly approving the most substantial changes in a generation to criminal justice laws, laws that have dramatically increased the federal prison population and created a criminal justice system that many conservatives, also liberals, view as costly and unfair. A conference call this morning with Chuck Grassley gave this reaction. This is part of what Senator Grassley, who is a big part of this push, had to say about it.
It was key that we seized and delivered when the moment was right. We had liberal Democrats like Senator Booker and the ACLU, very conservative Republicans like Senator Cruz and the American Conservative Union, and nearly everyone in between. It's rare to have such a broad bipartisan coalition backing our bill, including the president. To put it simply, this reform will be historic, and it's long coming. The Christmas season now, an untold number of American families will have renewed hope that their father, mother, son, or daughter will soon have a chance to redeem themselves.
Senator Grassley, this morning, that Senate vote 87-12. Also, our other U.S. Senator, Joni Ernst, voted yes as well. That package now goes to the House, where it's expected to pass. And I think the president has given his go-ahead that he will sign it. Rachel, let's start off with you. Somewhat surprising here, especially in these times that are anything but bipartisan.
Miracles do happen. The Senate.
In time for Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. The Senate can act in a bipartisan way. Criminal justice reform for the past at least 6 years has been pretty regularly cited as one of the issues where bipartisan compromise is possible. And they may come at the issue from very different directions, but both liberals and conservatives have for the past several years agreed that reforms are necessary. And so putting together this package and then, of course, moving it forward through the White House and particularly the efforts of Jared Kushner, that's been a real success story for Senator Grassley and all the other senators who have been working on this for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I'm remembering... half remembering Jared Kushner, you mentioned there too, in his family. This is an impact on his family, or he at least is relevant to his family.
Yes, his father was imprisoned, and so this is a passion project for him. He's been very vocal about advocating for criminal justice reform with the president, and clearly has the ear of the president. From that perspective, not a surprise. I would note, though, the one thing that we should be a little cautious about here is that only about 10% of our population of incarcerated individuals will be affected by this, because this only affects federal prisons.
Right. And Iowa has no federal prisons.
Right.
Right. So nothing in Iowa.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Historic, Senator Grassley called it, having covered the news for several decades. I remember many years of the trend towards lock them up more and more, mandatory minimums. Jeff Taylor at Dort College, your view on this historic passage of a bill which seems ready for a presidential signature soon.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to see it move forward as well. And I think, as Rachel points out, it's something that I think all of us, regardless of our political views, it's a pleasant thing to be able to see Congress actually acting in a bipartisan way. There was a little bit of opposition in the Senate, but not a lot, and a very broad coalition across the spectrum from left to right, and libertarians as well. And so I think this is something that's long overdue, partly at the federal level. Not all of this, but some of this is coming out of the decades-long federal war on drugs. And, you know, we can debate whether or not the federal government should be involved in enforcement of drug laws or not, but they have been since the 1970s, and that's part of why you have so many nonviolent offenders behind bars at the federal level.
Right. And this what is called the First Step Act, expanding job training, other programs aimed at reducing recidivism among federal prisoners, also expand early release programs, modifying sentencing laws, including those mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. Interesting. So it looks like that is sure to become law yet in this Congress session before 2019 rolls around. We talked about the Congress being able to act, Rachel and Jeff. Let's talk about inaction.
I would say now.
Let's pivot 180 degrees.
We've covered the miracle. Now we move on to the normal stuff.
We don't know what will happen yet, but Republican leaders say they're not sure what legislation the president would be willing to sign to avert a partial government shutdown this week. I think something like 25% of the government would shut down. Yesterday, hearing signals that perhaps the president backing down a bit on his demands for border wall funding. Let's listen to, back to Senator Grassley. He says he supports the plan of shutting down the government for this border wall.
I say I support this, yes, but nobody wants to shut down the government. It could happen. I hope it doesn't happen. But on the other hand, it seems to me that there ought to be a reasonable compromise.
Okay, a reasonable compromise. We'll see if that happens. A couple other voices before I have Rachel and Jeff weigh in here. In the first White House press briefing since late November, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked to clarify the current White House position toward the continuing resolutions being considered on the Hill. Here's her response when asked whether it is a demand for $1.6 billion in border wall funding, or whether it's supporting a continuing resolution to take this matter up after winter break. Listen to Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday.
You know, at this point, the Senate's thrown out a lot of ideas. We're disappointed in the fact that they've yet to actually vote on something and pass something. So when they do that, we'll make a determination on whether or not we're going to sign that. In the meantime, we're looking at every avenue available to us possible. The president's asked every one of his cabinet secretaries to look for funding that can be used to protect our borders and for the give the president the ability to fulfill his constitutional obligation to protect the American people by having a secure border. So we're looking at the other options. In the meantime, we'll see what the Senate does, and we'll let you know when we have an announcement on that front.
Okay, Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking about shuffling money around from other places without involvement of the Congress. Well, this is what the minority leader Chuck Schumer, the Democrat, said after his meeting with Republican Mitch McConnell. Schumer calls a $1 billion slush fund, in his words, for the president to use for what Schumer calls a radical immigration agenda. Here's what Schumer had to say. He's pretty clear.
Let me be clear. The Republican offer today would not pass either chamber. We Democrats have made two reasonable offers that could earn overwhelming bipartisan support in both the House and Senate. One, pass the six bipartisan appropriations bills and a one-year CR for the Homeland Security bill, or alternatively, a one-year CR for the remaining seven appropriations bills. The president said last week he would be proud to shut down the government. We Democrats don't want to shut down the government. And as for the idea of what Sarah Sanders Huckabee said, they could get wall money from NAFTA or some other part of the government, they need congressional approval. They're not getting it for the wall.
Okay. Jeff Taylor, a lot of maneuvering going around a few of the voices we heard there. What do you make of all this, well, about where we are and what's important to each of the parties?
Yeah, well, Trump has been frustrated, for better or for worse, depending on your perspective, on building this wall. It was one of the centerpieces of his presidential campaign 2 years back. We remember at his rallies, and this still goes on when he goes out on the road, of people chanting, build the wall, and so on. And yet, he's run into opposition not only from the Democrats, but more quiet opposition from the Republican leadership of Congress. Neither Mitch McConnell nor Paul Ryan really want a wall built or the border much more secure than it is for reasons of cheap labor, which the Chamber of Commerce and other business forces within the Republican Party have favored for a long time. They really prefer more of an open border. And so he's working at cross purposes not only against the opposition party, but really against his own party. And this is one area where Trump's been, very ineffective. He came to office with fears that he might be some kind of a dictator, but he's been very weak in this area of policy. And as I say, some of us think that's good and some of us think it's bad, but it doesn't surprise me that he seems to be losing another battle over wall funding.
Mm-hmm. And we have to remember where this started for a long time during the campaign in the first months of his presidency. It was still Mexico was going to pay for this wall. And then as of late, somehow NAFTA, the rework of NAFTA, makes it good. We can stretch our imagination and believe that is paying for the wall. Rachel, your view here also, border wall, border security. When we substitute security after border for wall, then it becomes a different discussion, doesn't it?
It does become a different discussion. And let's be clear that the border wall is in many ways a symbolic discussion, right? People who talk about building the wall, typically what they're trying to express is a desire to firmly define and defend the border of the United States, whatever that looks like. Mm-hmm. And so the wall itself, of course, was the centerpiece of Donald Trump's campaign. He got around any sort of conversations about budgeting by saying Mexico would pay for it. And let's just put on the table that Donald Trump is not a policy wonk. He did not come to office with detailed policy proposals that he wanted to put before Congress and weed through the finer points of policy. And so every time we get to a point where he has the opportunity to essentially say, look, it's going to be the wall or else, he puts forward the wall and he says, I'll shut down the government. I'll do whatever I have to do to get this thing funded. But inevitably, when it comes time to talking about those finer details, he waits for Congress to define what those details might look like. And he has to walk back just a little bit. I would just, for those who kind of see politics relatively skeptically, I think there's an alternate suggestion here as well, which is that Trump likes to talk about the wall. And in many ways, as he looks at what's going to happen over the next year and a half, 2 years of his presidency, as he heads into reelection, building a wall is actually perhaps less important to him than having the issue for the campaign. Mm-hmm. It's been a very effective issue among his base of supporters. As you put it, kind of a lot of back and forth and negotiation and kind of, grandstanding on this issue. And I don't think there's any reason to expect that any of this will actually result in $5 billion going towards a wall.
Mm-hmm. But will there be somehow, are the Democrats in a position to deny Trump a face-saving solution here, Rachel?
No, they're not. And they don't seem to want to. I mean, what's been put forward is, you know, he has said, I want $5 billion. They've come back with, okay, well, maybe we could do 1.6, 1.3.
And then put border security
on
that.
And that would be
that.
Border security,
right.
Yes.
Not the wall.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, we'll see where this goes. Jeff, unless you had further thoughts, we're going to move on to our next topic.
I was just going to say real quick, though, I agree with Rachel. She makes a good point that there's value in keeping the issue alive, but it's kind of a two-edged sword, because if Trump's base feels like a year or two down the road that he sold them out, or he really didn't fight hard, he really wasn't meaning to build the wall, he may find a loss of support as a result of that. So the face-saving, I think, is important in this particular battle.
If you just joined us, it's the Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jeff Taylor of Dort College in Sioux Center, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University in Des Moines. Let's move on into the big, broad area of the Russia investigation. Developments popping up several by the week now. Let's go to yesterday's development. Michael Flynn's sentencing is postponed. This is the president's first national security advisor, I think, in place about a month, the first month of his presidency. Yesterday, a judge in Washington delayed Flynn's sentencing until at least March to give him time to prove the value of his cooperation with federal prosecutors. Let me just summarize a little bit from the New York Times article on this. The judge expressing, quote, disgust at efforts by President Trump's first national security advisor to mislead investigators. Emmett Sullivan, the judge, person with a reputation for being hard on government misconduct, but he, according to the New York Times reporting, dismissed the suggestions that Flynn had been treated unfairly by federal agents. And the judge left no doubt that he viewed Flynn's crimes as serious enough to warrant prison time, even though prosecutors recommended that he receive a lenient sentence. Let's go back to the White House press spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, yesterday, asked whether it concerns the president that one of his top aides lied to the FBI and was working for a foreign government. Here's her response.
Not when it comes to things that have anything to do with the president. The activities that he has said to, and again, we'll let the court make that determination, to have engaged in don't have anything to do with the president. Let's remember what the whole thing that this started is supposed to be about. It's whether or not Russia influenced the election and whether or not the president had anything to do with it. We know that that Russia tried to create chaos within the election, but certainly not that they actually impacted it. The only reason that the president is the president is because he was a better candidate and beat Hillary Clinton. We also know that the president never colluded with Russia. So that's the whole reason that we have this, and we know those things to be false.
Is the president concerned that Michael Flynn lied to a representative of his own government and was working for another government during the campaign? Is that concern him or not?
Look, there's certainly concern, but that's something for the court to make that determination, and we'll let them do that.
Rachel Caulfield, what do you make of this development? Michael Flynn's there. I mean, there's a number of repeated lines there that are very questionable by Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Yeah, Sarah Sanders is doing double time right now.
That was a press conference disappointment of the press there. I think it lasted 15 minutes, and she hadn't given a press conference since back in November. So
right.
There was some upset, an upset room of reporters there. Go ahead.
Well, so, you know, over the course of the past week, a number of new lines of investigation have opened up. And the Flynn investigation, this is kind of the culmination of the Flynn investigation. So as this one seems to be reaching a crescendo, we see others kind of starting to you know, get up and running in the background, which we can talk about in a minute if we want. But the Flynn investigation, you know, what I thought was really interesting about the sentencing hearing yesterday, the degree to which the judge went out of his way to really ensure that the last ditch efforts by Flynn's attorney to say, look, you know, the government really acted in a way that was inappropriate in this case, did not inform Flynn of his right to an attorney, so on and so forth. The judge really went out of his way to say, okay, Mr. Flynn, you tell me, like, do you want to plead guilty? Are you taking responsibility for this? You know, and this is part of the narrative is kind of trying to ensure that as the team's work gets done, that there is some sense of resolution, public resolution to some of these charges. The fact that now the sentencing has been postponed in an effort to allow Flynn to cooperate more, I think is also telling, because Flynn, by all accounts, has been extremely cooperative so far.
Interesting, too, that the judge, I think he backed off of, I mean, incredible quotes.
Yeah.
Arguably, you sold your country out.
Yeah.
And then also mentioning treason as, you know, here, that then the judge, after the recess, the judge then said, don't read too much into the questions I ask. I'm not suggesting he committed treason. He was never charged with treason. Jeff Taylor, we're coming up on a break, but give us your thoughts on what this adds to the huge picture of the Russia investigation.
Well, the irony here, is that my understanding of the Flynn case, that primarily the issue at hand was that he was doing lobbying for the government of Turkey, and that he did not register as a foreign agent as federal law requires. And so I'm struck by the fact that the Mueller indictments, at least of the Americans that have been rolled out so far, there's little to nothing that actually has anything to do with Russian collusion. So on the one hand, the idea of treason and that Putin picked Trump to be his candidate and Trump was part of this conscious conspiracy. We're going to have to wait to see for the final report, but it's interesting that if the proof is in the pudding in terms of indictment, there's been almost nothing that actually has linked the Russian government to the Trump campaign. So it's lying to the FBI, it's incorrect filing of federal taxes, it's a variety of different charges that have been brought, campaign finance violations in the case of Michael Cohen, but there just doesn't seem to be much there, at least that's publicly revealed at this point, having to do with Russian collusion.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, do you see it the same way?
Well, I do. I think, when these investigations, this is a massive investigation by Robert Mueller. And so, you kind of have to pick off chunks as they come. We really don't know what these hours and hours and hours of conversation, cooperative conversation with Michael Flynn have yielded at this point.
Right.
We know that, charges are for the most immediate actions, but Mueller's been very clear. He's not showing his hand early.
We will see that in 2019.
Yeah, he is slowly amassing evidence, and so we really don't know what Flynn has said with regard to any sort of relationships or meetings with the Russians.
Okay, you hear the music? We've got to take a break.
Yep.
Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Jeff Taylor of Dort College, our political analysts on board for this Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Ben Kiefer back with more on the Russia investigation and a number of other things. We'll be back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
So good to have you on board on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Hey, tomorrow, you just heard him in the news there, Matt DeLisi, a sociologist at Iowa State University, specializing in criminal justice. He'll be on the program tomorrow to talk about this criminal justice reform bill that will soon, it looks like, become law during the hour. So tune in tomorrow. Also, some really interesting new findings of a study that Matt DeLisi of Iowa State University is involved in about predicting the future, recidivism, depending on what type of violent crime was committed by that person. Tonight, rather today, why am I leaping to tonight, Rachel and Jeff? I don't know. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Jeff Taylor, professor of political science at Dort College in Sioux Center. Jeff and Rachel, at the beginning of the program, we were talking about the uncertainty over the possible government shutdown at the end of the week, the president's desire to have that $5 billion for the long-promised wall. Floyd is joining us from Ottumwa. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Floyd, welcome to the program. Are you there? Floyd? Going to give you a few more seconds, Floyd? I guess not. We're having some technical problems there. Let's go. Let's pick up where we left off here, the Russia investigation. These are some strong words. Let's listen to them. On Monday, the former FBI director, James Comey, we have to note here, a registered Republican for most of his life, ripping into Republican lawmakers for focusing their closed-door questioning of him on the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server and the so-called Steele dossier. Comey complaining that GOP lawmakers should be more concerned about President Trump's attacks on the Justice Department. Listen to what our former FBI director and Republican has to say about Republican lawmakers here.
So another day of Hillary Clinton's emails and the Steele dossier. This while the President of the United States is lying about the FBI, attacking the FBI, and attacking the rule of law in this country. How does that make any sense at all? Republicans used to understand that the actions of a president matter, the words of a president matter, the rule of law matters, and the truth matters. Where are those Republicans today? At some point, someone has to stand up, and in the face of fear of Fox News, fear of their base, fear of mean tweets, stand up for the values of this country and not slink away into retirement, but stand up and speak the truth. I find it frustrating to be here answering questions about things that are far less important than the values that this country is built upon.
Okay. And Jeff Taylor, you get the first crack at it. What do you think of former Director James Comey of the FBI's words there? Pretty harsh.
They are pretty harsh. And obviously there's a history here between Trump and Comey, and Trump ended up firing Comey. The interesting thing is that I suspect if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, she probably would have fired Comey as well, and probably not have let him even serve out that first year, or however long it took, before he got the axe.
Right. There are
Trump
plenty of Democrats who are still steamed at Comey. Right. Yeah.
Right. He was not. And although he wraps himself in very high-minded language, there was a widespread perception among both Republicans and Democrats that he mishandled that investigation with Clinton every step of the way. He wasn't really seen as handling that in an appropriate way. So.
Just to break it, I mean, sure. To the point of what he's making here, is there a reason to question his integrity here? Mishandling is one thing, but his integrity as an FBI, former FBI director.
Well, there may or there may not be. I don't think because he is a former FBI director, or the fact that he's kind of been a pillar of the Washington establishment for a long time, that means that everything he's been, has done has been above board or even non-political. I mean, although he has been a registered Republican, you got to remember that Trump came in and really kind of had a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. So there were a lot of people in D.C. And in New York that were pillars of the GOP that I'm sure not only didn't vote for Trump, but were horrified when he was elected. And I'm guessing that Comey is one of those.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, your view on this strong statement by former Director Comey?
Well, so on the issue of Hillary Clinton, James Comey made one really critical error in telling the world that the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails was being reopened right before the election. Mm-hmm. And his conduct regarding the investigation of Hillary Clinton has continued to be a key talking point and point of critique among Republicans in particular, which is perhaps unexpected. But it gives them a way to assert basic equivalence with some of the complaints and concerns and critiques that Comey has raised against President Trump. So it's a political talking point. It's an opportunity to effectively go on the defense and fight back against James Comey. He has seen himself since his dismissal from the Trump administration, he has really seen himself as kind of a whistleblower figure, somebody who's willing to stand up to power and speak the truth and protect the reputation of the FBI. And clearly that's the role that he was taking on after he walked out of this 5-hour hearing yesterday.
Wow,
I mean, that's
yeah.
that's a long period.
And if we can imagine a time, I don't know, how many years in the future when we can look at this as a historical event, I guess we'll have a better view of mm-hmm. James Comey's role. Let's go to James in Des Moines. James has been listening and called 1-866-780-9100. Welcome to Politics Day with Rachel Caulfield, Jeff Taylor. James, thanks for calling.
Well, in response to what you were just talking about, I look for allegiance to the country, not to a party. So I think James Comey, you're right, he did commit that one grievous error. But I think otherwise, even though his motive was pure, it should have been plain and simple to him. But mm-hmm. what I'm calling about is when you have somebody who operates like a mafia don, their hands are always clean, the dons are. And so you don't get them on the specific crime. The most famous case being Al Capone. He never went to prison for any of the crimes he committed except tax evasion.
Mm-hmm.
So if they find wrongfully filed taxes, they find the people that worked for him were colluding with the Russians or had improper contact with the Russians and clearly representing Turkey when you're the national security advisor, that plain and simple on its face ought to be knowledgeable. That should be intuitively obvious to the most casual observer that you can't have allegiance to both your employer, Turkey, and the country of which you're supposed to serve, the United States, as its national security advisor. So not getting trumped on any of the campaign stuff, get them on what you can.
James in Des Moines, thank you very much for your perspective. Let's wrap up this portion here by just asking you, as we see each week delivering new revelations and developments for the Russia investigation, each of you, when you put it all together, Rachel, let me start with you. When you put all together, the last few weeks have been incredible. Where do you see this heading?
You know, if I knew the answer to that question,
the murky nature of it becomes clearer, doesn't it or not?
Well, it does. I think one of the things that has become more and more apparent to people who have watched this closely and are willing to allow for the fact that this was not malicious or intentionally ill-conceived is that, you know, Donald Trump comes from a very different world of how you interact with people. He comes from a family-run business where informality tends to be the name of the game, where he expects loyalty and has generally had loyalty among his closest aides, many of whom are his direct family members. Moving into government, I think we're becoming more and more aware of the ways in which that private business Donald Trump is very, very different from our expectations and norms of how we expect presidents to behave in the office. Where it ultimately leads, I don't think we know yet, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that, you know, there will be more legal proceedings against more Trump aides. There is this Justice Department norm that an expectation that a president will not be indicted. And so from there, it's a political question.
Jeff Taylor, your words.
Well, to me, I think in the end we're going to get a report from Mueller that is very strongly worded. I think there's going to be strong criticism, probably allegations that there was collusion. But I would be very surprised if we get any indictments or clear-cut evidence that actually proves that collusion took place. I've been skeptical of this from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I feel like this has been a hoax. I know this goes against conventional wisdom, but
Jeff, a hoax in what way? Define that.
What I would say is that I think it began as a way for Democrats during the fall campaign in 2016 to not just point out Trump's kind of naive approach, saying that, oh, he Putin's a good guy, and yeah, I know Putin, and you know, going on as he did during the GOP debates, but as a way of saying, okay, we're going to demonize Putin, we're going to then link him to Trump. And I think eventually, when Clinton lost, this became a way of the Obama administration and the Clinton campaign as a way to explain how she could have lost to Trump. And so I think there was a partisan motivation, and then it dovetailed in with the intelligence agencies that did not want Trump coming in and having some kind of an end of the Cold War or a prevention of a full-fledged Cold War with Russia. So I think it's policy-driven, and I think it's partisan-driven. And I would be very...
Very much like you subscribe to the deep state theory.
Yeah, there is something to that, and it's bipartisan. So somebody like Comey, who is not going to be a Trump supporter, from the get go, I'm sure he was a Jeb Bush kind of Republican. I do think that this is the way Washington works, and so yeah, in this situation, as I said, the proof will be in the pudding. Is there going to be any indictments that actually link Putin not only to Trump, but even to his subordinates of actual conscious manipulation and cooperation between the Trump campaign and the Russian government? I'd be very surprised if they ever bring that forth.
Mm-hmm. And would you be equally surprised, Rachel?
Well, I mean, I would be surprised if they have definitive proof that there was intentional outreach or intentional contact between the highest levels of the Trump campaign and the highest levels of the Russian government. I think we've already seen that there were at least casual interactions between Trump campaign staff and a number of Putin allies. But the degree to which you can demonstrate collusion, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, collusion is not actually a crime. there's right. no definition of collusion
so
in this
about
context.
Conspiracy against the United States.
Yeah, so it's unclear exactly even what would prove collusion if it did exist. And so, I mean, I don't think we're going to see a definitive legal charge here. I do think that we will see a well-written and fairly incendiary report issued by Mueller, and it will bring together a lot of information from a lot of different sources, and it will bring that to light. And I fully expect from there that, as I said, I think it's a political question. I think the House is going to have to decide what they want to do and move forward from there. But I don't expect that we're going to see some, you know, big break from precedent and see Mueller try to step forward and, for example, indict the president. I don't think that's going to happen.
Get another caller on here before the hour's ending. Josie is with us in Evansdale. Have to ask you to be brief with it, Josie. We're sure glad you're on the air, though. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I guess just kind of adding on to what you guys were discussing, some red flag for me is why all the lying? It seems like the charges that have been coming up have been lying to people. So what is the big cover-up? Why is everyone lying? To me, it just kind of is a red flag. I didn't know your thoughts on that.
Okay. We'll see. I don't know if we had any other thoughts other than wait and see, right?
Well, wait and see. I think a lot of people got in over their heads on some things. You got to remember, I always said about the Trump campaign that it was scrappy, right? You didn't have a lot of polished political operatives running the Trump campaign. You had a lot of people who were new to politics. You had a lot of people who, even if they weren't new to politics, they were new to working at the level that they were working in the Trump campaign. And so I think a lot of people got in over their heads very quickly with some contacts that maybe they didn't fully vet or they didn't understand how problematic those connections might be. And so, you know, when the FBI comes knocking and you realize that maybe you did something you shouldn't have done, let's put it this way, whether or not the lying itself is an intentional effort to cover up knowing disregard of the law or knowing efforts to break the law, that's different than lying to the FBI because you're really not sure what kind of thing you've gotten yourself wrapped up in, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, right. We have about 5 minutes left. We have callers, but I want to jump to this quickly because it came out on the weekend, and we'll have to be brief with it. Wish we had more time for this. Some new CNN, Des Moines Register, MediaCom mm-hmm. polling over the weekend. Let's look at the Democratic side here. First of all, former Vice President Joe Biden holding the top position in this first poll among likely 2020 Democratic caucus goers. Behind him, Bernie Sanders, Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke joining as the only candidates in the double-digit support field. Jeff, how do you see the Democrats positioning themselves for a long caucus season?
Yeah, I'm thinking we're going to see maybe as many Democrats running in 2020 as we saw Republicans running in 2016. So I think it's going to be a very exciting, very interesting kind of campaign. I think these early numbers, you know, a year out really before the caucuses themselves, I don't know that this is going to hold. I think this is primarily name recognition. So mm-hmm. Biden is the most famous. He's run two campaigns for president, flamed out early, didn't do well in either of those. But maybe the third time is the charm. One of the downsides of Biden is he's going to be very old. A lot of the frontier candidates tend to be on the older side, but I think it's going to take time for some of the fresher faces to rise to the top of the polling.
Okay, your comments on the Democrats, Rachel, quickly.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think at this stage, you know, you see a list of names in front of you. You tend to go to the ones that you either the names you know or the people you feel like, okay, they're viable, right? Enough people know them that they're viable. I think what's more interesting about the poll than the top three in double digits is the questioning about whether or not you want a fresh face or somebody who's been in politics for a little while, and more Democrats seem to prefer somebody who's been in politics for a little while. And then the second piece is, do you think that the Democrats should go with somebody who can win or somebody who shares positions on your positions on the issues that you care about? And more people say they want to go with somebody who can win. And so when you put all that together, you know, this is a Democratic Party that I think has been very eager to say, look, we're changing. We're bringing new voices, new faces into this party. We're not just going with the same older generation, more mainstream candidate. And yet the poll seems to indicate that voters are kind of looking for the more mainstream, you know, viable candidate who has some experience.
Okay, we've got a couple callers. Let's try to get them in short order. Can only give you about 30 seconds, Larry. I know you wanted to react from Olwine about to something in the program. Go.
Well, I wanted to mention that using the investigation's word hoax seems to be taking the Trump Kool-Aid to a pretty large degree. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
The use of the word hoax is pretty amazing there.
Okay. Larry, in Olwine, thank you. We're jumping over to Des Moines. Mike, very quick.
Yes, welcome. I have a very quick. I'm just curious of what your guys' feelings are about holding other members of government to the same standard as we are right now with Trump and the scrutiny of the investigations with Mueller and the Russia collusion. Should we have the same scrutiny and the same style of investigations with Hillary Clinton, her emails, and her aides, and the people that were a part of that, as well as other members of government that have probably been involved with numerous things.
Okay.
And just your feelings about that.
Mike, thanks for the question. Rachel, can I dish that off to you?
Boy, this is going to be quick. I think on the whole, we have always treated the power of investigation for sitting government officials as something unique and special, particularly for the presidency. And sure, you know, we should always be investigating criminal wrongdoing. But when it rises to criminal wrongdoing or the possibility of wrongdoing among people serving in the administration, I think we've always taken that more seriously, or we've invested more government resources in that.
A quick comment before we go on this strength of the president among the state's registered Republican voters, according to the poll last weekend. Trump earning 81% approval rating among Iowa Republicans.
That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Quickly, your thoughts on that, Rachel?
Well, you know, for a little while, Iowa seemed to be a place where Donald Trump's approval ratings were dropping just a little bit. And this is, I think, demonstrating that that's not the case, that Iowa Republicans are pretty firmly behind the president.
Okay. Jeff Taylor, a few seconds for you.
Yeah, I think both parties doubling down. You know, Trump came in with very fierce opposition by Democrats. I think that's rallied his base around him into defensive reaction. So it is amazing that it's that high, but I think it's this polarized field that we're seeing.
Right.
And I'm going to very quickly say it's interesting that the trade conflicts have not driven those numbers lower.
Right. Okay. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Jeff Taylor, professor of political science at Dort College. Thank you so much, Rachel and Jeff, for joining us on this last Politics Wednesday of the year. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us again tomorrow.